one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The first thing we have tonight, we have a presentation. Diane, are you going to do that? Okay.
Good evening, Chairman Mayfield, members of the board, Mr. Thomas and Mr. During. I'm here this evening to present the recipients of the Earl Pride Scholarship Award for 2008. I'd like to give a little bit of background on the award. In 1990, Mr. Earl Pride passed away, and he gave us a legacy of $48,000 inheritance and death or inheritance to Santa Claus County. And the only thing he put on it was that it would be disposed of as county employees saw fit. So he left it wide open for us. We did some surveys and did a ballot, and the item that actually passed overwhelmingly was to establish a scholarship fund that would be opened for higher education and open to all county employees and their dependents. So the initial scholarships were done in 1994. Since that time, we've awarded over $35,000 in scholarships, and that's without touching that initial endowment. And in addition to that, the money that from interest, some of the interest earnings is identified each year to also go towards the endowment to build that fund. Currently, there's just over $58,000 in that endowment, so we see the ability to continue making scholarships into the future. Due to the high quality of applicants this year, the selection process has been a difficult one, as it always is. We received over 20 applications, and we awarded 4 scholarships. I'd like to acknowledge the work of your appointees to the committee and to publicly thank them today. They are Stacy Della with Behavioral Health, Greg Gaudio with the Alliance WorkNet, Jan Gauthier with the District Attorney's Office, Bruce Merchant with Alliance WorkNet, Marianne Rucker with the Planning Department, and Susie Siebert from the Board of Supervisors. The 2008 scholarship recipients have exhibited not only outstanding academic performance, they've also displayed concern for their community. We are honored to present them to you today, and they will be presented in alphabetical order. We did award 4 scholarships, and we have 3 of those individuals here this evening. The first scholarship awardee isn't able to be here this evening, but he did extend his thanks. And that first recipient was Michael Sims. He graduated from Turlock High School, where he was this year's valedictorian. Michael will be attending the University of California, Los Angeles, and plans to major in aerospace engineering. He's been very active in his community. His Eagle Scout project was the planning and construction of a sidewalk and benches at his church and providing picnic area access to the elderly and the handicapped. Michael's father is John Sims, and he's employed with the Children and Families First Commission. The second recipient is Kritishi Surti. She graduated from Modesto High School with a 4.6 GPA. She'll be attending UC Berkeley, majoring in electrical engineering. Kritishi has been involved in numerous school and community activities, including the academic decathlon and the science olympiad. She's also volunteered at the county library and Habitat for Humanity. And Kritishi's mother, Kapani Surti, is employed by the clerk recorder. Kritishi? Okay. The next recipient is Brianna Viscano. She's also a graduate of Modesto High. She plans to...
Wait, give them one at a time, or you get them all up?
One at a time? All?
Bring them all up.
Okay. Brianna plans to attend Otis's College of Art and Design in Los Angeles. She's passionate about her art, and some of which has been displayed at the Mifflin Gallery here in this building. Brianna plans to intern this summer for fashion designer Gustavo Gadil. Brianna's mother, Amelia Viscano, is employed by the Community Services Agency. Brianna? And our final recipient is Jennifer Wallace. She's a recent graduate of Modesto High School with a 4.6 GPA. She'll be attending University of California, Davis, where she plans to obtain an undergraduate degree in genetics. And then she hopes to enroll in UC Irvine's graduate program to become a certified genetic counselor. Jennifer is a member of Catalyst, which is California Taking Action for Learning Through Youth Services team. She She's volunteered for Santa Claus County's Agricultural Commissioner's Office and at the Farmyard Experience at the County Fair. Jennifer's mother, Carolyn Sizemore, is employed by the Agricultural Commissioner's Office. Jennifer.
I got to make sure that I have the right ones at the right place here. This $58,000, we're not giving it all away, are we?
No, we're not giving it all away.
Okay. Okay. I was just going to say, you're going to come here and leave here rich. It's my pleasure tonight to get to award these certificates to you and also to say there's a check in here. Okay, and spend it well. Okay? It's my pleasure tonight to give you these checks. I don't know how much they're worth. Quite a bit?
Quite a bit.
Oh, my God. Okay. Okay. Would you like to say a word to the audience?
Sure. Go ahead.
This is your chance.
Go ahead. Please thank us.
At least thank us, okay?
Thank you for the scholarship money. It'll be really helpful paying for college since it's so expensive. And
good.
It'll be something that I'll always remember.
Okay, how about you?
I feel really honored to have gotten this scholarship and really thankful for the help for college because it'll be really useful.
Good, yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. It's an honor to be chosen as one of 4 out of 20 people who applied, so it's a real honor to receive it. Thank you.
Well, this is something I never got when I was going to school. I was never that smart. Hey, congratulations. Thank you.
The members of the committee wish each recipient continued success, and we hope this award contributes to the realization of their goals and dreams. We also want to thank the Board of Supervisors for this opportunity to publicly acknowledge these outstanding individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. The second one we have tonight, we have a resolution. I think this is the, this is the week of the, Jerry? Okay, the week of probation.
Probation Services Week in Stanislaus County, and in fact, it's actually Probation Services Week nationwide, as proclaimed by the President, statewide as proclaimed by the Governor, and countywide as proclaimed by your esteemed body. I was thinking about the GPAs I heard there, the 4.6 GPA. If you had doubled mine in high school, it wouldn't have equaled 4.6. So, quite an accomplishment. As I said, this is Probation Services Week, and it's being celebrated nationwide, statewide, and in Stanislaus County as well. Probation has evolved from its early beginnings in 1841, when a wealthy Boston bootmaker named John Augustus posted bail and took responsibility for inebriates and rehabilitated them in exchange for receiving his bail money back. To the profession we have today, where probation is involved with virtually every social service agency, mental health, law enforcement, and school organization, and virtually every county department, with the exception of animal services, I think, and we're working on that. I would like to thank all of the animal supporters for coming out today to acknowledge my probation staff, by the way, as well. Our county population has exploded in the last 10 years. We're certainly in one of the worst economic downturns of my career. Our resources are stagnant at best, and in many areas are being reduced. Our caseloads are larger than ever. In fact, we're responsible for over 8,000 offenders in our community. We're being stretched in more directions and further than we have ever been. Yet the members of the probation department come to work every day, determined to provide services to victims and resources to offenders to return them to law-abiding citizens. And in the event they don't want to become law-abiding citizens, we're certainly committed to removing them from our communities so that our neighborhoods, parks, and schools can be safer. The members of the probation department provide these services professionally, with dignity, perseverance, and always adhering to a code of ethics that holds them to a higher standard than the average citizen. The citizens of this county should be particularly proud of the 250 individuals that make up the probation department that serve our county citizens. They are without a doubt 250 of the finest dedicated professionals I have ever had the pleasure to work with. It is doubly humbling for me to have the good fortune to lead them. Quite frankly, I'm not sure lead is the appropriate word. It's probably more accurate to say that I get them the resources that they need and I get out of their way so they can do what they do so well. I have three staff members to receive the proclamation tonight, and as they head to the side to come up to you, I'd like to ask the members of the probation department that are here tonight to please stand and be acknowledged for their efforts. We have three individuals that are going to receive the proclamation. Each year I bring the employees of the year to you to receive the proclamation. Typically it's four. This year, first in line, we have Cynthia Siegel, who is a supervising legal clerk and was named the department's supervisor of the year. Second in line is Leah Valente, who's a DTO3 and was the deputy probation officer of the year. I might also say she's an absolute outstanding multitasker in that she's the mother of triplets. And third is Marie Stewart, who is a legal clerk 3 and our support staff of the year. Unfortunately, our fourth person, who is our probation corrections officer of the year, or sadly I should say is not here, that was David Mendez, who was a probation corrections officer too. David died earlier this year of a brain tumor, so he can't be with us. But I would ask that you present the proclamation to the staff who are here.
Thank you, Jerry. Unfortunately, there's no check in here. Okay. But here is the resolution. It's my pleasure to present it to you three ladies. Okay? And on behalf of the board, thank you for a job well done. Being done, well done. Okay?
Thank you very much. On behalf of the Stanislaus County Probation Department, thank you very much.
That's it? Thank you.
The next we have is the we have the West Side Resource Conservation District. Are they here tonight?
Yes.
You guys are gonna you're gonna talk to us too, huh? Okay, come on up. Is it good or bad?
We think it's good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all good.
All
yep.
Positive.
Okay.
Good,
positive. Only positive things tonight. Okay.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for letting us come and tell you a little bit about the RCDs. Our county is privileged to have two RCDs in our county. We have an east side and a west side. I'm going to be representing the east side, and my name is Mike Pasalacqua, and Norman Crowe is going to be representing the west side. So thank you for letting us come, and we're hoping that maybe we can work out with you some other things. That we're going to offer you some services, so we hope that you'll be able to use those.
Offer away.
Mm-hmm. Well, first question everyone has is, what is a resource conservation district? I never heard of it. What does it encompass? Well, I think we're going to have to go back part of you.
Wait a minute. Use that microphone. That way you can really get to these people.
Thank you.
Attaboy.
First of all, we've got to go back quite a few years to the Great Dust Bowl. After the great devastation of the agricultural land in the Midwest, farmers needed assistance to reclaim the land so they could farm it again. Out of that organization of farmers joining together, they were formed what they call resource conservation districts. Out of that, the United States Department of Agriculture worked out an agreement that provided technical assistance, and that fueled what they used to call Soil Conservation Service. So from this, resource conservation districts now exist across the entire United States. Most of them come to you, and there can be one to several per county. Out of this agreement also changed, well, there was a name change several years ago. It is now called the Natural Resource Conservation Service. But what these farmers and ranchers and dairymen did, they joined together, formed this resource conservation district. A memorandum of understanding was worked out with the USDA They would come in and provide the technical assistance to make the improvements to preserve the natural resources, air, water, and land. And that's what a resource conservation district is. It's made up of a local group of farmers and ranchers and dairymen who now make the direction of local choices of how to best serve the resources, preserve what makes their living.
As Norma's saying, the purpose as a board director, member of the RCD, you know, it's great to get in and actually talk about it and be concerned about the soils and the air quality and certainly water. There are many, we could fill up pages of actually what we do. Certainly, we conduct surveys, research, we assimilate information, we offer services for educational programs, we can do things for the district attorney, legal counsel, we can do it. We have a vast, endless array of talent and professional people to help us with this, and incredible also. So if it's something to do with water, air, any kind of natural resources, we certainly can offer a service to anyone, and we do offer services to any. Also, the function of the RCD provide the technical and financial educational assistance to help. It's not only rural, but it's also the unurban parts of our county. We do all of that. We encompass everything in the county. Certainly, we could help a city out with a problem. It's just as we could as any other farm or maybe a co-op. So we have the ability to do any of those.
The leadership. The board of directors respond to the needs of the agricultural community by responding to the challenge and the resources. We receive training. We have annual meetings. We have a state association of resource conservation. We also have a national group for resource conservation districts. So we're getting assistance from many different directions and providing this information and education. And that's one of our biggest roles is information education. We do outreach to all services. We work with the youth in the county. We work with all the farmers, dairymen, anyone that is interested. We also work with any environmental group that has concern over certain issues that we have jurisdiction of working through. So we're very broad. We bring all stakeholders to the table. We're very open. All our meetings are run according to the Brown Act. So it's a unique experience at a local level having this much control over your destiny or what provides you for your livelihood.
Now a little bit about the East Side RCD. We encompass about 984 square miles. We were established in 1996. We actually were several groups that we pulled together. And the Salida had an RCD, the STNJ RCD, which was basically out towards Maids Ranch, that area, also took in portions of Bolico. Our resource priorities, again, we want to make sure you understand, we're concerned about the water quality, the dairy waste management, endangered species, and habitat. And you're going to hear a little bit more of that as we go on in the presentation about what we do about that.
The West Stanislaus Resource Conservation District was made up of two RCDs. The first was the Ortiz-Timba RCD, and it was in 1952, it was organized. And the primary purpose, believe it or not, back in 52 was to put a dam on the Ortiz-Timba Creek to get recharge of groundwater. So it's ironic, here we are back at this point, we're still looking at that. But we were combined in 1980, thanks to the Board of Supervisors here in this county. We joined the two RCDs together. We now encompass the 380,000 acres. And the nice thing is what we get to do is we get to prioritize local resources. We implement a plan by assisting land users, landowners, and providing the technical assistance with our partners, our partner being the Natural Resource Conservation Service. They're located in the Ag Center. They're in service and Crow's Landing Roads. Now the nice thing is what we also could do is now we could follow up with financial assistance. Now that's the key for everything, unfortunately, in today's world. Everything is quite costly. But we have field practices that we cost share with, we have workshops, we have meetings, and we have public hearings. So we're very broad in what we do, and we provide all types of assistance. Governance. The board of directors were appointed by the supervisors, you that I stand before. We're appointed for a four-year term. We follow the Robert's Rules of Orders. We follow the Brown Act. and we attend all the county workshops that you provide for us to stay current on all the legalities of holding public meetings. We seek advice on specific legal issues through county council. And the nicest part of it all about an RCD is we're locally led, locally driven, and locally funded.
You know, I have the privilege of being associated with some other special districts, but this one is a little different. The source of funding is very different. If you can see that public and private grants make up 93%, over 93% of our funding. We do have some endowments, some property tax, a small amount of our budget, 1.4% is. Fees and some activities are also about 1.4%, but donations are about 5%. But we are not, we're proud of our public and private grants that we get. We actively seek those, and we think we're pretty successful about doing it. Also, the biggest part, and this is the thing that what we really want to stress, is partnerships. And with partnerships comes success. And you can see the amount of partners we have in projects on the right side there. We can partner with vast groups and been very successful with that. We were able to take the smallest project, we don't mind what the cost is, and we'll take a very large project. It doesn't matter. Landowners, we want to outreach to the landowners, nonprofit organizations, certainly schools, county and state and federal agencies, and that's where we want to make sure that you understand that we want to be part of your system. We can be part of your system with the people we have. There are projects you have that are going on or will go on in the future that we could help you with, and we want to make sure that we can offer that to you.
Now I'd like to talk to you about the more important part that gets everyone's attention real quick is the money. Currently, the Stanislaus County Natural Resource Conservation Service is the largest funded county in the state of California for cost share monies for environmental quality projects. And it's unbelievable. We've been $3.2 million into this county through the USDA. They found that in the recent studies that we got an 8-to-1 multiplier bringing that money back into the communities. Those farmers, ranchers, and dairymen now spend those USDA monies back out throughout the community. What are these practices? What do we do? Well, one of the biggest things we have is erosion. That's one of the biggest things that we're concerned with right now, because obviously that, as drain waters run off, they cause a pollution problem. Well, on the west side, one of the biggest ones we worked with was the polyacrylamides, or nicknamed PAM. They're organic compound matters that will walk on the soil particles, and they'll make them retain in the field so the water in the runoff is perfectly clear. We do sediment basins, and we also cost share with drip and micro and sprinklers. But one of the big items is improving water use efficiency. Water obviously is a big item because we don't have it now, obviously, and we've finally hit that unfortunate point where we're short on water. So we have lots of workshops for growers. We've shown how to use this more efficiently of what they have, where their inefficiencies in their field operations. We have a mobile lab that goes out, basically does an evaluation of their system, gives them a report card at the end saying, hey, here's what are the improvements you made. Here's a problem. Maybe we have a problem with your pump. Maybe you have clogged sprinklers. They'll find the issues and work with the grower. Water quality is one of the biggest things, as we all know. We're all, whether you be a city or in the ag land, working with the Regional Water Quality Control Board. But we have the funds to help these dairymen and the farmers to keep our waterways fluid, prevent any animal effluents making it there. Also, farmers receive technical and financial assistance to remove any pesticides from the water. So we're there, we're working on the technology. Not all the technology is there. We're working with the USDA, and the unique thing is we work with all stakeholders. We work with cooperative extension, we work with private chemical companies, so we're always on the cutting edge. Maybe we're not the best at tooting our horn and telling us what all that we do, but we're very, very active trying to be proactive and be the best stewards of the land, so to speak, out there. Air quality, we work with the local San Joaquin Valley Air Resource Control Board. We're currently working with a dairy nutrient plan. We're working with best management plan with these dairymen on how to best handle their waste, whether it be liquid or solid, coming off the dairy to
to improve air quality. We're working with PM10, again, and now PM2.5 to make those improvements, to be the good steward, to show that we can be there. We also do conservation tillage is another item we work with. We work with cover crops and orchards. Those are all cost shareable items. There's diesel engine replacement. The state has a program, but NRCS also has a USDA program for diesel engine replacement. There's cost share for road oiling, for reducing PM10 dust, and there's another program that we're instituting reduction of pesticide use. You can actually get cost share dollars for reducing the use of pesticides. So we're about as proactive, we're on the cutting edge as anyone ever was.
Our next slide is dairy planning and assistance. It's in the dairy industry, it's a new world. It's definitely, you wake up today and it's definitely, with the amount of planning you have to do and reporting, it's overwhelming. Most of our dairymen don't understand it, haven't been able to grasp it. But through our education and our programs, we've been able to help them with that. We've offered, as Norm said, money for that. We've developed programs to do this. We've offered assistance in that. So we're hoping, you know, just as one day it was the Dust Bowl, well, maybe today it's the dairymen we're trying to protect. And that's what we're doing. That's how our organization works. We identify these things, and we go after that. We try to make that. So hopefully with all we're doing for our dairymen, we certainly want to save that industry in this county. It's a very important industry. And I can tell you, just working with the dairymen in my area, that quite a few of them think they're not sure it's worth it. And we're hoping that through these programs that you see on this page that we can make that, we can make it easier for them. We can't make it happen for them. They have to participate. But at least we can give them the avenue to continue on.
Water quality monitoring. On the west side, that's become a very hot issue, and it has for many, many years, and we've recognized it. The soil type we have and the methods we irrigate, we have runoff. Runoff leads to problems because things get picked up in the runoff water. Get pesticides, nutrients. One of the projects we did clear back in 1990 was called a hydrologic area. What we did there, we realized that we have organochlorine pesticides, which is DDT. And you say, well, DDT was banned 35 years ago. Why are you having DDT in your sampling and getting into the San Joaquin River? That shows you the life of DDT in the soil, that it is still there, and its breakdown compound, which is DDE. So through this practice started in 1990 and following through, we set up a standard of 300 milligram per liter of reducing the solids in the water because the pesticides then are attached to it. At this point right now, we've received a 72% reduction. We've met the 300 milligram per liter reduction of getting that sediment out, which in also entices the pesticides to be attached to soil particles to off-site movement. So I think that's great strides. It's taken a lot of money, a lot of technical backup through NRCS, a lot of commitment on behalf of the growers. No, we're not done. Yes, we have a long ways to go. Right now we're working with Project 84. There's $2.5 million that are going to be designated for Ingram, Hospital, or Stimba Creek, again for water quality. Our work is never over. There's new technology. A company out of Australia, Landguard, recently came up with an enzyme that would have the ability to digest Lorsban or chlorpyrifos. So it's a great technology. It's learning how to manage these. These are called best management practices. So it's this learning process that we go through. But the technology is there, very cutting edge.
A little bit about the conservation easements that we participate in right now. We do have some riparian habitat, wildland and farmland protection programs. We are concerned about all those. Those are very important to all of us. I don't think that you could go out into the public anywhere and ask, you know, what should we do? And anyone would tell you that, well, exactly, we need to do something to protect that. Well, we are involved in doing that, and we're not actually just talking about it. We're on the ground doing this. We have projects in process. Actually, we both have projects. We just located another project on the Tuolumne River not too long ago. So we both work together on these projects. I'm not sure that you know that all the time, but you do help us do these things. The partnerships with the NRCS, the Friends of the Tuolumne River Trust, City of Waterford, we have private landowners that help in this. We have property along the Tuolumne and other rivers that we have actually bought, taken the easement. The East Side RCD actually owns a parcel that we have actually bought and put into it. And that goes right into the education because we use that part for our educational part of our RCD education is a very important part of that. So we actually had a school group come last year, I believe, at the Salida Union School District, and their whole curriculum is built around this easement that we own. And they certainly have a, they've developed a curriculum called the Tracking the Tuolumne, which they present, and they give that every year. They believe they participate in the fourth and fifth grade where they actually come out, they plant trees, bushes, they come out the next year, measure how they've grown, they do soil analysis, they do water analysis, they take fish out of the river, they actually cut them open, see what's going on. So there's a whole curriculum built out of that that we have provided the educational and the outreach for that. We hope to continue that. That would be something that it's always a challenge, but we are in the process of doing that. One of the other things is that was interesting is I told someone I was going to make this presentation, and they were asking me, I was telling them about this in the RCD and kind of explained it to them. They were asking me, well, are you an environmentalist? And I said, well, I think I'm a conservationist. I'm not sure what the difference is, but I always tell everybody I'm a conservationist. So that's how I go on about this business. So, are there any questions from the board at all?
No, keep going.
Well, we hope you get a little bit of a glimpse of what we do. We certainly can offer you some assistance in many things. We mitigate many things. We have many projects going on, and we're here to help you with anything we can.
And really, thank you for the time that you put into it. Your commitment is commendable. Most people wouldn't do that, and it's free.
It's free.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's free. Thank you very much.
Again, thank you for the report. Thanks. This is a comment, public comment period. Does anyone have anything to talk to the board about, with the exception of the animal control animal thing tonight? I have one. Okay, which one is that? Stanford? Okay, come on up.
Good evening, yeah, my name. Speaking to you guys a couple times tonight, I guess. I just wanted to take an opportunity for the public comment period. I don't know how many of you are aware, but this afternoon, 11 individuals, it looks like, were...
Back up a little bit. That a boy. There you go.
That's got to replace it.
No, you're doing fine. Just
get out of our budget hole. 11 individuals were indicted earlier today by federal agents, federal indictments, arrested. With that motorcycle, place they had in the Nair and that sort of thing. And I just wanted to say briefly, Sheriff Christensen has assured me, and I have full faith in him, that our sheriff's office as a department, its integrity will continue to shine through, these hard times. For a long time, we haven't really known what's going on. We have a little scant stuff the bee's been able to kind of pieced together. There has no really recognition of reality, but I truly believe that as the facts of this case come out, we will get through it. And we have a wonderful, wonderful sheriff's department. I said before, I've seen a lot of departments, and the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department has a long, rich, admirable history, and I believe that they're going to shine like they've never shined before under Sheriff Christensen's leadership. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else? If not, we have a 6:30. Consent calendar. Okay, well, we need to pass on the consent calendar. I need to pull B2. Okay, B2 we pull. Is that B2? Yeah, okay. Can I have a motion for the consent calendar other than B2?
Don't move.
Second it?
Second.
Okay. Move the second over here. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried 5-0. Okay, now B2, we have, DeMartini, you pulled it. What do you want to know?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
He's coming down. We'll let him get down here.
Yeah, but... Okay. Since this was a summary of the Stanislaus County's investments in our pool, there was... I just wanted to ask the treasurer how secure these are. We have $30 million, I see, in the Freddie Mac, and it's been in the news quite a lot this past week. And I see we have $84 million in Bank of America. So my question really is, how secure are these things, especially the one with Freddie Mac?
Well, Chairman Mayfield, Supervisors, I'm Gordon Ford, Treasurer Tax Collector. And we're looking at the May investment report for the county pool. It's conservative, safe, almost $1.2 billion portfolio with an average life of about 8 days. If you look at the individual investments listed in the May report, you'll see we have a substantial holding in federal agencies, much larger than you were mentioning. Both coupon securities going out to 2010 and a large number of discount. Maturity in 2008. These government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs, include the Federal Home Loan Bank, Federal Farm Credit Bank, Federal National Mortgage Association, or Fannie Mae, and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, or Freddie Mac. Recently, there's been a lot of news coverage on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Federal National Mortgage Association was formed by Congress in 1938. It's referred to as FNMA and authorized to do business as Fannie Mae. So you can see it listed in either way, Federal National Mortgage Association. The Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation was formed by Congress in 1970, referred to as FHLMC and authorized to do business as Freddie Mac. In 1968, Fannie Mae converted to a private corporation, and in 1989, Freddie Mac stock could be owned by investors. Most of the articles in the newspapers have been regarding the stock price of these agencies, and that's not an issue for us. We're not allowed to own stock in the portfolio. That's probably the most important statement. We own debt issued by the agencies. And while there was some concern regarding the ability for these agencies to issue new debt, on Monday, Freddie Mac passed the critical test and investor confidence when the auction of short-term debt was met very strongly. People wanted to buy it. The United States Treasury investments are considered the safest investment for a public agency. It is generally accepted that agency investments are the second only to the Treasury. They're safer than anything else in the portfolio. The agency paper in our portfolio all have AAA ratings from the rating agency, which, of course, is the highest rating they can have. It's generally believed that the government-sponsored entities are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. Treasury Secretary Paulson has asked for permission from Congress to expand the credit to the agencies and invest in them if necessary. Treasury Secretary Paulson has asked proposed legislation to increase the two GSEs' line of credit with the Treasury from the current $2.25 billion in each to unspecified higher amount to allow the Treasury to purchase stock in Fannie and Freddie. The Federal Reserve has taken the action of allowing Fannie and Freddie to borrow directly from the Fed. If Congress approves Paulson's proposal, it would explicitly solidify the government's backing. And while this action would preserve the debt market, our investment, it wouldn't do much for the shareholders, who could still be hurt. Both President Bush and Federal Chairman Bernanke were on TV today to reassure the public of the safety of these agencies. At this time, I don't see any reason to be concerned with them. or with our portfolio. If you look at the distribution graph in the report, you'll see that we have a relatively short-term portfolio. Most investments mature in less than 180 days. We have both safety, liquidity needs to provide funds operation for the next 6 months, and we'll continue to monitor the market and place investments in the priority of safety, liquidity, and yield as specified by state law. So the bottom line is I don't see any risk.
You don't? Okay. What about the Bank of America? You didn't touch on that. It's $84 million in that. I mean, how most of the deposits are insured for $100,000. I think we got $84 million in there. Is that a different type of investment?
You're talking about, let me see if I can turn to the right page here.
Let's be on page six.
You're talking about what are called banker's acceptances.
Uh-huh.
Banker's acceptances have both the security of the bank and the physical product. For example, when, say, cars are shipped from Japan to the United States, the Japanese want to be paid right now when they leave the port, and the people receiving it do not want to be paid until it's received. So banker's acceptances are issued with a security, such as a shipment of cars behind it. And the bank stands behind it. In the event the bank failed, the product stands behind it, and there's insurance in case it were to sink at high sea. In over 75 years, there's never been a loss in banker's acceptance.
Okay. So I wasn't sure what it was.
Understand?
Sure we didn't lose.
So what you're telling us tonight, you're telling us that you're not too worried about Bank of America going under?
No, I'm saying that even if Bank of America went under, we still have protection.
We still got 100,000.
No. We still got the product.
Oh, okay.
Which better be worth
$84 million instead of 100,000, right? Okay.
100,000's not going to recover.
Okay. About Freddie and Fannie. They're going to be backed by the federal government to begin with. They're going to put in trillions of dollars into that thing.
Basically, if you go as Paulson anticipates with Congress, with our current people, both with the President, the Federal Reserve, the Treasurer, all recommending to Congress that it be backed fully by Congress and by basically the press of the United States.
Mr. DeMartini, are you satisfied with the Freddie and Fannie report?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. I've been looking at this over pretty carefully, so I wondered how secure were we really with this, because it's been in the news so much. Have we ever lost any of our investments?
No, but I know we've never lost anything. We've been very conservative, safe investment. The only possible danger is a major shift in the way American operates, and I don't see that happening. These things were formed by Congress, supported by Congress. It would take a major change for Congress to say, no, we don't want to support them anymore. And I really don't see that happening.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, with that, Supervisor DeMartini, would you like to make a motion to approve this or accept it or whatever you want to do?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll move to accept Treasurer's
B2?
Yeah, item B2.
Can I get a second on that?
I'll second it.
Okay, let's move to second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Carried 5-0. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, with that, now we get to go down to the 6:35 public hearing, and we're going to talk about the animals, and I think most of the people here are ready. I've got a bunch of people who want to talk about animals, but we're going to hear the report. You'll all get a chance to talk about it. Okay.
Evening, Chairman Mayfield and board members. Dave Young, your interim director of Animal Services. Here assisting me tonight is Deputy County Counsel Deirdre McGrath. Technical worker over here on the end is our Staff Services Coordinator, Andy Fiskum. And if I need additional help, we have our office manager, Mavis Williamson, our field supervisor, Dorothy DeGino, and our confidential assistant, Linda Ford. So I'm,
you're Mr. Young.
Yeah, I'm Dave Young.
Oh, you're okay. Go ahead.
What we're here to do tonight is to ask the board to approve our 2008 fee schedule. What I'd like to also do is alert you that in the future, this fall, I'd like to come back to the board and provide you an update on the effectiveness of the pet overpopulation ordinance, which the board passed in 2005. I know that certain members of the board would like to see some changes in that ordinance, and at that time I'd like to propose some changes to you. After that, I'd also like to come back to the board in the fall or the winter and ask for some revisions to the Stanislaus County Code Title VII, which are the animal control laws for the county. Those laws have not been updated for a number of years, and we are currently in the process of comparing our animal ordinances to those of our comparison counties and some of the cities in the region. So we'll be coming back at that time to do that.
Let me ask you before you keep on going, are these things you're going to come back and talk to us in the fall and later on, or are they going to be something we'll be doing tonight?
No, sir.
Okay.
No, sir.
Right.
Most of the fees that Animal Services charge have not changed since 2004. We did a comparison of the standard seven comparison counties that the county compares with, say, for salary negotiations, that sort of thing. And in that comparison with those counties, we discovered that our animal services fees are 25 to 50% below the average of those comparison counties. We also discovered that we currently do not charge for many of our in-house veterinary services. As you know, 2 months ago, we were very fortunate to hire Dr. Quan Stewart as our new full-time veterinarian. And it became apparent to us that we had no mechanism in place, no fee structure in place in which we could charge citizens for services that he might provide to owned animals inside the shelter. And as I'll talk about a little bit later on, at our monthly clinics, we had no fee structure in place whereby we could charge the public for vaccinations if we provided them by our own county staff. With adoption fees, part of our survey was to ask the comparison counties what types of services that they provide whenever they adopt out an animal. And in discovering that not only are we at the low end of the scale on the fee that we charge for an adoption, we actually provide more services to the citizens for those adoptions than all the other comparison counties. In deciding what level we should charge for adoptions, I specifically excluded the option of itemizing every single service that we provide and every single cost that's included in caring for the animal, preparing it for adoption. If I included all those costs, our in-house estimate is that we would be charging the citizens at least $204 per adoption if we established our fee in that manner. What I have done is asked that you increase our adoption fees for dogs by $15. I think that's a modest increase and should not affect our adoption rate for dogs. Our 20-year history of statistics at the shelter show that cat adoptions have always been less than dog adoptions. Dogs have always been more favored. Today, cats enter the shelter at much greater numbers than dogs entering the shelter. It's a substantial part of our pet overpopulation problem. We have difficulty adopting the cats out, although our facility is open 7 days a week, and we keep all of the cages in the cat adoption area full of cats. We simply cannot adopt out the cats. So my proposal is that we specifically do not change the current cat adoption fee of $45 as the only incentive that I can think of at this time to attempt to make it still attractive for the public to adopt out the cats. Amended fees, in your packet you have the schedule of the amended fees. These are services that we already provide, but again, because of our survey of the comparison counties, we need to come up to the median level of those counties.
And that would include things such as reclaims, impounds and quarantine fees, board and care. Prior, we only charged the person $8 a day for the board and care of their animal. We want to change that up to $15. So that's just an example. One of the, what I think would be one of the major changes is the unaltered dog license fee. Back in 2005, as part of the pet overpopulation ordinance, this board instituted an unaltered license fee of $100 per year and then graduated higher for if you bought a two-year or three-year license. And in that ordinance, then they created the altered license fee of $12. The idea being that it would be a big disincentive for a person not to alter, spay or neuter their dog because they'd have to pay a $100 fee. So you created that $100 fee level, and for an altered dog it was $12. We did some analysis of the results for the last 2.5 years since the pet overpopulation ordinance went into effect, and we discovered that at the time the ordinance went into effect, 70% of all the licensed dogs were altered. Today, 82% of all licensed dogs are altered. So in my opinion, it is because this board instituted the higher fee of $100 for an unaltered dog that in the last 2.5 years we've had a 12% increase in the number of people who have altered their dog. So in my opinion, if we were to add another $50 to that annual license fee, as well as we have suggested that we raise the two-year and three-year fee if people wanted to buy a two-year or three-year license. In my opinion, that in the next 2 to 3 years that we should see, again, an increase in the number of people who alter their dog. And if we have the same results in the next 2 to 3 years that we had in the last 2.5 years since we instituted the pet overpopulation ordinance, hopefully we will be 90% or better in the number of people who have licensed animals who have altered their animals, thus having a more positive impact on the pet overpopulation problem. I'd also like to add that the state of California, their policy goes along the same line. Currently, if your dog is picked up as a stray and you come to the shelter to reclaim that animal, state law says that if your animal is not spayed or neutered, that we issue you a fine. We assess you a fine, $35 the first time, $50 the second time, $100 the next time. So the state already has it as part of their policy. Their overall intent is that people spay and neuter their animals. Currently before the legislature is AB 1634, which I looked on the website today and I couldn't find out what the activity was. It had a hearing yesterday. The votes all along have been in favor of AB 1634, and what AB 1634 will do if passed by the legislature is it will raise those impound fees that I just described to you of what a person will have to pay to reclaim their dog if it's not spayed or neutered. And also in that legislation, if it passes, it says that on the second occasion that Animal Services receives a complaint about an animal and that animal is not spayed or neutered, it's mandatory the animals be spayed or neutered. Now, the one category of complaint that is excluded is a barking dog or a cat that makes a noise. If you complain to Animal Services and we respond on the second time, if we go out and your animal is not spayed or neutered, the law says mandatory it must be. So I can't predict whether that's going to pass or not, but that's just to indicate to you that we aren't the only ones who feel strongly about animals that are not spayed or neutered. New fees. As I mentioned earlier, currently we have no mechanism in place if we used our own in-house county veterinarians to do vaccinations. We have no fee mechanism in place to charge citizens for that service. We also have no mechanism in place to do charge for deworming flea treatments. And since we have a new veterinarian on board, we think it's the appropriate time to institute that level of structure for animals that, number one, either come into the shelter as strays, but it turns out that they are owned by an owner, and that owner comes to reclaim that animal. We would charge them not only the reclaim fee, but we would charge them our costs for any veterinary medical care that we provided to the animals. Also, with the hiring of a new county veterinarian, he has established a five-tier structure for fees, going from a routine exam to a very extensive life-saving treatment. So some of those are new fees, some of those are amended fees, but we'll have a five-level structure there which we can recoup our costs for services provided to the public. And one new fee that we're asking for are trip charges for large livestock. Currently, if someone calls up and says there's a horse or a cow in the middle of the road and we don't know who it belongs to, and can animal services come and pick it up, we have to call an animal services officer who's already in the field in a truck that's only designed to carry cats or dogs. He or she has to drive into the shelter, get a pickup truck, hook it up to a cattle trailer, and then drive out to the site and then bring the animal back in. We don't have a method right now to recoup our costs for that, so we're asking you to institute that as well. The next item would be the Stanislaus County Alternative to Euthanasia Skate. I think most of you are very well aware that currently the skate vouchers cost $50. That has been the fee for the last 4 years. Out of that $50, $12 goes to pay for a one-year license, $6 pays for a rabies shot, $17 goes for a microchip to be implanted in the animal. That leaves $15, which is applied toward the spay and neuter costs out of that $50. And chief probation officer has already left the room, but even if my GPA in high school was at his level for math, I can tell you we're losing money. A cat spay and neuter can cost anywhere from $52 to $100. A dog spay or neuter can cost anywhere from $98 to $224. This is based upon a set rate schedule that has already been accepted by the veterinarians and has been in place for 1 to 2 years now, whereby if I take a voucher in and redeem it at a participating veterinarian, they agree in advance that they will only charge the county based upon this particular rate schedule. And the variation of the rate schedule is based upon, number one, whether it's a male or a female. The male surgery is easier to perform than the female surgery. It's also based upon the weight of the animal. The larger, the heavier the animal, the more complex the surgery. Therefore, we have this sliding scale. But we have run the numbers over and over and over and over again, and if you were to average out the average cost of the bill that I receive from the participating veterinarians, the average cost to the county, to the taxpayers, is $136. You remember from the prior screen of the $50 that people pay for a skate voucher, only $15 is applied toward the surgery costs, which means $121 of every surgery is being paid for by the county or the taxpayers. What that also means is that the person who buys a voucher is only paying for 11% of their surgery costs. So what I am proposing to the board tonight is a two-tier voucher system. The first tier would be a low-income voucher priced at $72, which equals 25% of the surgery costs, and a standard level voucher, which would be $140, which equals 75% of the surgery costs. What this would do would place more responsibility on the pet owner for the costs of caring for that pet, and less responsibility on the government, but it still provides an incentive
to the citizen to participate in this program. Even if they would charge the $140 fee, I'm confident in saying that what they would pay to us in that $140 is much less than if they went out on the open market themselves to get their spay or neuter done by a private veterinarian without using the services of the voucher system. And I'll be quite honest with you, how did I come up with a 25% and a 75%? That is based on my own personal opinion of what I believe is reasonable. If you were to ask all the members in the audience, if you were to take a survey of the public, it's going to be the full spectrum of opinion. Some people are going to say they don't believe it's the job of government to provide free care for somebody's pet. You, at the other end of the spectrum, you will say, there will be people who will say, yes, it's government's duty to provide that service. I can tell you my own personal opinion is at the other end of the spectrum where I don't think it's government's job to do that. However, that said, as the director of animal services, I can tell you that we have a pet overpopulation problem in this county that's getting worse. It's not getting better. There isn't anybody in the private sector who's doing anything about it. So I think, unfortunately, it falls upon government to try to do something to alleviate our pet overpopulation problem. The skate vouchers are one method of doing that. And so, in my opinion, I think 25% of the cost is a reasonable cost to ask a person, if they choose to be a pet owner, that they should at least pay 25% of the costs for the spay and neuter. And I think that it's totally reasonable to ask a person who is financially capable of paying for a spay and neuter to pay 75%. And I would say at this point in time, with this fee structure in place, we're only talking about doing 200 vouchers per month. But if we are successful with this new fee structure, we would have the capability of providing more vouchers than just 200 per month. And I would interject at this point that at an earlier meeting, the president of the Coalition for Cats and Dogs, Susan Robinson, made a proposal to you that we should spend all of our money in one shot at one time for spay and neuter rather than spreading it out over the entire year, that would have a greater impact. I like that idea, and I would say that unless the time comes that in this county we find some method whereby we can do spay and neuter on a massive level, not just 200 a month, but a massive level, 2,000 a month, consistently over a period of years, until we find the funding mechanism to do that, we're not going to solve our pet overpopulation problem. As far as eligibility for the low-income vouchers, the eligibility factor would be, number one, both the pet and the owner have to be residents of Stanislaus County. And number two, what we would accept from the person requesting the low-income voucher is any government or public utility-issued document that predetermines low-income status. And I've just given you an example there of what some of those documents could be. This is not necessarily an all-inclusive list. What we specifically do not want to do is we do not want to establish our own criteria of who is or is not low income. We specifically do not want to get into the business of becoming eligibility workers. I don't want someone coming to me and producing their bankruptcy document saying, I just declared bankruptcy, therefore low income, or someone coming in and producing their income tax return and saying, I have 10 dependents, therefore I'm low income. I don't want to get into that business. My people aren't trained to do that. They're not qualified to do that. So what I'm saying is, if when the person arrives at the vaccination clinics where the vouchers are sold, and they can produce to me some document that says they have already been predetermined by some other government agency or by a public utility as being low income, then that will be the only eligibility criteria that's necessary. So, in essence, to wrap up my portion of the presentation, the figures that you see there would represent what we believe the potential for our income would be. Now, I'd like to emphasize here, because some of the board members have mentioned to me in the past that they feel like animal services in prior years and presentations of the board have been less than truthful or misleading or misinformed you on how successful these various programs can be, either in reducing the pet overpopulation or in the revenue that could be generated. So what I have done, what my staff did, is we went backwards in time to the year 06-07. And for every single transaction that we did, for every skate voucher we sold, for every clinic that we went to, if we were using the fees that I'm suggesting to you tonight, if we had used those fees on all those actual events that occurred in 06-07, our revenue could be anywhere from $320,000 to $500,000. The reason there's a variance on skate is we took all those skate vouchers that we sold in 06-07 and we said, okay, if everybody was a low income, then we would have made $77,000 more. If everybody was a standard voucher, we would have made an additional $290,000. Until we implement this program, if you approve it tonight, until we implement this two-tier system, we really aren't going to know what the public's reaction is going to be to it. We really don't know how many people will show up and want a low-income voucher. We don't know how many people will want a standard voucher. So this is why we give you this wide variation. Under the clinics, the last item, the reason you see the 17,000 figure there is in the past, at the once-per-month vaccination clinics that the county sponsors, we have used private veterinarians under the auspices of a private trade group to provide the veterinary services. They would keep all the fees collected for the vaccinations as fees to pay for their services. Since we now have a full-time county veterinarian on staff and we have a part-time veterinarian on staff, Dr. Robert Pollard, who comes down from Sonora and assists from time to time, and Dr. Pollard states that he's more than happy to take over these clinics. By retaining all of those fees at the clinics, by using our in-house county veterinarian staff, we would realize $17,000 at a minimum of additional revenue to the county. So that would conclude my formal presentation, and I'm available for questions.
I know everyone, just a minute, man. Okay, hold on. Okay, well, you talked about the fees for the low income. Is there a limit on how many dogs they can have that bring in? I mean, when you give a skate voucher out, okay, is there a limit to how many dogs these people can have that we're going to pay for?
No.
Okay, that's good enough. No. Okay. Okay, and then we'll start down here, Bill.
Just one question. On the increase that we see in the skate program, will 100% of those funds go back into skate? So you have an estimate of $77,290,000. Will those dollars go back into the skate program to
Yes, sir.
Very good.
Because that's part of the pet overpopulation ordinance that requires it.
Okay. Okay, Dick?
We discussed the other day, and could you give more information on cow dogs and et cetera like that? We had that discussion of working animals.
Yes, yes. The question was, is there any exemption to the $100 or proposed $150 annual fee for an unaltered dog? And the answer, there is an exemption. If you have a working dog, if you have a show dog, if you have a service dog, if it's a law enforcement dog, those are exempted and they have a lower fee. Senator Monteith asked me, well, how do you prove that it's a working dog? And I told him that I've only had one person who ever called and asked that question, and they said they lived on a 5-acre ranch and their dog herded their sheep. And I says, okay, you give me a date and time and I'll send an animal control officer and he'll stand at the fence and he'll watch and see if your dog can herd the sheep. And they never called back. And so very few people ask for that exemption, but it's there. It exists. Thank you.
And you said something about a 2-year program. You want to raise it $50. Okay, on a 2-year thing, would it be some kind of break on that two-year thing?
On the second year, if you wanted a 2-year license, it would be $250, which, yes, would be a $50 break.
Okay.
And if you wanted a 3-year unaltered license, it would be $350, which would be about a $100 break.
Okay. Okay, DeMartini.
Okay, you said in part of your presentation that the state was considering raising the fees for impounds. I'm just curious on that. Does that money wind up then going to the state, or does it stay here at the county?
The answer is the money, is, even though it's a state-imposed fine, it goes back into our own coffers for spay and neuter here in the county.
Oh, okay. That's a surprise. They usually wind up stealing everything from us. The question that I had was, you said that the licenses for altered dogs is up 12% because of the $100 fee, and you think it'll go up to a higher percentage if we raise it to $150. And how do you know, maybe you do, but how can you tell if somebody gets a bill for $150, they just won't license the animal?
It's very possible that they'll do that, and a lot of people do. But then, we send them notices that they have a bill due. We inform them that they have the right to go to animal court to protest the fees. And if they still ignore us, then we send them to collections.
You do? I mean, suppose they just say the animal died. I mean, I just wonder if there isn't going to be more people trying to get out of this, and if we raise it up, and it actually won't do any good. I mean,
a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, some people attempt to have fees waived, attempt to have fees lowered. But I would say that the majority of people, once they have received a citation, the majority of people will comply with the law. And I will tell you, and it will probably be part of one of my future presentations, is that when we send people to collections, we currently have outstanding $1 million in collections and have only recouped $100,000, and that's over a 5-year period. So it's that collections process that I think is a grist for a whole other meeting and discussion. But we do send people to collections, and for a lot of people, the threat of having a lien of some sort by the county tax collector is enough to make them comply.
Okay, the revenue recovery is already run by the tax collector. Okay, just a couple other things. I mean, your predecessor, when asked how this pet ordinance was doing, said the overpopulation of pets is getting better. And you tell us that it's getting worse.
I can tell you that we just finished the fiscal year, and this last fiscal year, the intake, the number of animals, exceeded 21,000. So the number of animals that are coming in is going up. I can say we also went up in our adoptions and we went down in our euthanasia. But I can tell you right now, because of it's that season for litters, that I'm having 500 animals per day or more in the shelter. The cat room, when I went through today, it's abysmal. I mean, the shelter's been called, atrocious and all other kinds of things, but the cat room was just overflowing with cats. The hallway was full of cats. We have cages sitting in the parking lot with cats. The pet overpopulation problem is getting worse. It's not getting better.
Okay.
I know this wasn't part of your presentation, but I'd just be curious of your opinion about our litter permits, if that seems to be working, because I see occasionally, you know, animals for sale in the paper.
Well,
there's no number in there, and it's...
You're stealing all my thunder for next October, but...
it's important to me. We really weren't spending a lot of time on this ordinance. We want this thing to work, and I don't know what the problem is. If the problem, you tell me, is getting worse, then we need to find out what we can do to get it done. And raising fees is not just going to really just solve the problem.
The portion of the litter permit ordinance that I think was successful is when we raised the unaltered license rate to $100. I'm not going to be the one to make the proposal because I don't want my house burned down. But if you licensed cats...
Know where you live.
Yeah. If you licensed cats, if you made cat licensing mandatory, that would begin to curtail your pet overpopulation program, a problem. But specifically about litter permits, the litter permit portion of the ordinance has only been partially successful. To date, I think we've only raised about $80,000 in revenue over the 2.5 years. That the ordinance has been enforced. The litter permit provision is extremely, extremely difficult to enforce. It's very time-consuming. It requires that an employee every day sit down and start at the very top of the want ads and has the data entry into an Excel spreadsheet or another type of spreadsheet every single one of those ads in the paper to see if it corresponds with a prior day ad. After having done that, then you have to start making phone calls. Sometimes you make a phone call and nobody's home because they work during the middle of the day. Or when you get someone on the phone, you can try two different tactics. The most successful tactic is if you tell them you're from Animal Services and you see that they have an ad in the newspaper and why don't they have a litter permit. That actually is the most successful tactic to get people to comply. The other tactic is if you pretend to be a prospective buyer and so you engage the person in conversation, how many animals you have, how old are they, how much you want to sell them for, and then you attempt to make an appointment to come view the animals. If you're successful in making an appointment to come view the animals, now you appear on the person's doorstep, and we purchased a vehicle that we did not decal with county decals or insignia, so it's, you know, an undercover vehicle, if you want to call it that. And the litter permit officer arrives in plain clothes, greets the person at the door, and hopefully the litter is still there. Sometimes you arrive and the litter's all been sold and gone. If the litter is still there, then now you have your on-view violation and you can issue a citation. That whole process of doing that is very labor-intensive, time-consuming, and ultimately the officer, after having gone through all the want ads, doing the data entry, making all the phone calls, making the appointments, actually can only get out to the field to 2 to 3 appointments per day. Sometimes he shows up at the appointment and nobody is there. We also have the problem that we have a legal opinion that we need to change the wording of the ordinance because we are not allowed to enforce the ordinance on anyone who is not a resident of the county. If you live in San Joaquin County, Calaveras County, some other county, and you advertise in Stanislaus County, our legal opinion says we cannot enforce the ordinance against that individual. And a substantial portion of those advertisements come from out of county. We've also been advised that we can't enforce Craigslist or any other type of internet advertising for animals. So it sounded good on the face of it, but in actual logistics of trying to put it into effect, very difficult.
Why can't you enforce something on an internet list?
That's what my lawyers tell me.
We got our lawyers here. I'll tell them you can't enforce it. It's something that the board passed.
I'll defer to Deirdre McGrath, who's looked at this particular issue, but it has to do with the nature of the Internet being unbounded, so to speak.
Well, we don't even require the Modesto V to even put in the numbers. That's where we ought to start, at least.
Well,
that's what I look at, you know, when I look for that, and I see all these ads in the paper without the permit number. Can we require them at least to do it?
No. I can tell you the conversation. Excuse me, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I can tell you the conversations that I had with the Modesto B in late 2005 when I was again your interim director and we instituted this ordinance. The Modesto B will tell you that First Amendment freedom of the press, they have the right to print anything that they so desire to print, and that the government can't regulate what they print. They are also a for-profit business. They make part of their money, their income, by those classified ads. Now, I have talked to various members of the editorial staff. There are some members of the editorial staff who are totally in support of the pet overpopulation ordinance. They're in support of our efforts to reduce the overpopulation program problem. And there are other members of the editorial staff who take a very opposing view and don't believe in the litter permit process. And so even within, you know, their own organization, they're not unanimous in whether this is a good law or a bad law. But I think they have been cooperative in that when you call up to place an ad, they advise you that there is a county ordinance that requires them to have a litter permit number, and they do publish on most days when I look at the ads, there is a little disclaimer where they print that you're required to have a litter permit number. So I think, you know, they have gone a certain distance to help us, to assist us, but, you know, the bottom line is it's freedom of the press, and if they don't print those ads, they lose income.
Okay, well, I could ask you questions all night, but I'm just going to stop here. I just, I really like to see this pet ordinance work better, and I'm not convinced that just raising all the fees are just going to solve everything. But well, one last thing, I had a pet store who, this is the last one,
is there, okay.
who's complained that somebody left a either a box of kittens or puppies, after one or the other, I can't recall, right at the doorstep. They took them in and just put them up for sale. Then they got busted by the animal services for selling animals without a litter permit when they didn't raise them themselves. They were just dumped off in the store. I mean, have you? What would you have to say to that pet store owner?
I'd say that is true. That did happen. I'm the one who did it, and it was in 2005. So yes, sir, I did do that.
Okay. You still doing that sort of thing?
I haven't had the occasion to have my officers go back into the pet stores and do any enforcement efforts. Although we are going to do that soon, due to a new complaint I received about how some of the local pet stores are doing adoptions, that they're specifically in violation of your ordinance and that they're refusing to tell people where the animal came from. Refusing to tell the name and address and origin of the pet that they're adopting out.
Okay, moment. Stop. Thank you.
Okay, before I open the public hearing, you say you've only collected out of $1 million in fines, you only collected $100,000.
Yes, sir. In the last 5 years.
Well, DeMarcini, that's worse than Freddie and Fannie. Wouldn't you say so? Okay, this is a public hearing. I'm going to open the public hearing right now. And then I'll start reading off these cards up here. Please, if you're going to talk about the dogs and the cats, kind of make it short and sweet so we can get this thing done. Dave Ciaretta? If I've mispronounced your name, tell me when you get up here and I'll read it again.
Dave Cerruti.
Okay, that's good enough.
Chairman Mayfield, supervisors, staff. My name is David Cerruti. I'm chairman of the Animal Advisory Board. I have Augusta Farley and Nancy Smith, also members of the Advisory Board. The board has reviewed the proposed 2008 fee schedule. It is the board's recommendation that you approve the fee schedule as presented. The current schedule of fees is well below the state average. The increase will bring additional revenue to the shelter and further assist in the goal to build a new shelter, educate the public regarding the proper pet ownership, and ultimately reduce pet overpopulation and help us become a no-kill facility. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Karen Moser.
Good evening. My name is Karen Moser. I've been a resident of Ceri since 1958. I'm a member of Alley Cat Guardians since 2000. I'm a feral cat and TNR advocate. I am an active feral cat giver. I have several colonies in Stanislaus County that I take care of on a regular basis. I would like to make a few comments about raising the prices of the spay and neuter vouchers. Stanislaus County Animal Control is euthanizing more than 13,000 unwanted dogs and cats a year. The county has to euthanize 4 out of 5 cats and kittens it receives at the shelter. This is cruel, expensive, and pointless. If the county can find the money for euthanasia, they can find the money for spay and neuter. We have a major cat crisis in this county, and raising the prices of the spay and neuter vouchers at this time is only going to make the problem worse. A cat can reproduce at 6 months old, have 4 to 6 kittens per litter, and can have 3 litters a year. Stanislaus County needs aggressive, low-cost, targeted spay and neuter programs to finally stop these unwanted kittens from being born. Raising the prices of the vouchers will not bring an end to this overpopulation problem in this county. Thank you.
Thank you. Sally Mares?
Good evening. I want to thank you first for approving the animal shelter and its expansion. It's something that's been needed for a very long time. I was reading in the Modesto Bee, and this kind of sums it all up, the problem of thinking from all these people that just don't get it. It says, for instance, the adoption fees for dogs now $75 are raised to $90, still lower than average. But given that dogs and cats are sold on the private market for hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars, it's still a good deal. But they're not getting it. They're not getting the fact that there's a big problem that's going on here. I have to apologize for getting preachy about this. This is very dear to my heart. The animals in this county apparently merit the most minimal of transparent, empty responses, like putting a new, more expensive Band-Aid on a malignant tumor that is growing each day. There is a major crisis, an epidemic of huge proportions, and the response is to raise fees on the good people of this county who can't afford it anyway. A lot of people can, sure, but that's not the reason not to do it. We need to get these animals taken care of. It's like a sieve. There's animals that are falling through this sieve. We're plugging up a little hole. And that's all there is to it. There needs to be something done aggressively. The veterinarians need to get on board. There needs to be more and more veterinarians. Give them incentives. Give them incentives on what they can do in order to get to help with the situation. They're the ones that have the expertise. We're going to need their help. But they also need to, I'm sorry, I'm very emotional about this whole thing. They need to step up. They need to be given incentives if necessary for maybe the county or the city to provide them with advertising or some kind of charitable giving write-offs or whatever they need to get them on board. You know, a lot of veterinarians are on board because it's in their heart to be on board, but a lot of them aren't, and we need their help. We give a lot of consideration a lot of times when people get up in arms about inanimate objects, buildings or something like that. That's all well and good. But the animals really need our help right now. And just making up fees and all these other kind of things, we are not doing it. There needs to be a sweeping effort that will take care of this problem. Maybe 6 months. Pour everything that we can into it. Get this whole thing under control once and for all. This has been going on way too long. And it's not about fees. It's not about these things like a business transaction. These are lives. These are lives that need to be taken care of. They need to be, they're not asking to be here. You know, and we all should be responsible enough to do something about it. It really makes me ill to see celebrities parading around with their little fashion accessory dogs, but we're actually no better. We're arbitrarily deciding if these animals' lives fit our lifestyle or not, like Colosseum style. You know, you can live or die, thumbs up or thumbs down. There's a big problem. You all know this. We need to take care of this once and for all. I am against the voucher system currently that they're proposing because it is too expensive. And right now we need to plug up the holes first. Then and only then can we implement a good program that will maintain everything the way it is. But we need to start from square one. We're not even close to being at square one. This situation is way out of hand. There needs to be something done about this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Linda Sherman.
Well, I'm sorry that the probation staff left, because what I wanted to say first is old probation officers never die. They just take up new causes, and mine happens to be animal welfare, having served this county 30 years as a probation officer in the past. And the last time I spoke to you on September 18th, 2007, it was about the skate vouchers and the fact that the county had decided then that they were going to stop making the vouchers available at the county-run clinics. I mean, they were going to be available there, but not over the counter. And what I pointed out to you then is that in August of 2007, a total of 553 vouchers were sold. I happen to have statistics from October 7th of 2007, and only 169 vouchers were sold. And that was after you agreed to, and they implemented this change where they would not then sell the vouchers over the counter. That's a huge drop. And I want to thank the board for giving the Animal Services Department extra funding in December and again later this spring to keep the skate voucher program working for a little bit longer. But as you all know, in the months of May and June of this year, they stopped issuing any vouchers because they were out of money, and apparently they didn't want to come back and ask you for more. As I said last September, to me, the vouchers are a critical component of the effort to reduce the number of animals born and those that end up dying in the shelter. I agree with many of the changes and many of the fee schedules that Dave has proposed, and I know that that staff has worked very hard on that. I think the biggest problem that I have with it is, and I'm a person who's, I bought a voucher for a kitten I adopted a year or so ago. I could afford the $140 in this raise. My concern is low-income people. I really am very concerned about raising that $50 to $72. I think a lot of low-income people have had a hard time coming up with the $50. I think we're going to make it harder for them to get a voucher. That's my primary concern. I would just like to address Mr. DeMartini's comment about the litter permit. Last year at one time, I went through the Penny Saver little newspaper that comes around. I called every person who had cats advertised for sale just to see if they had litter permits or that kind of thing. There was only one person in Stanislaus County who didn't have a litter permit. The rest of them were all from out of our county. They were not Stanislaus County residents. And the other thing you asked about, you know, the pet store situation. I have a friend right now who lives in the same mobile home park where the woman died last week from the heat stroke. And my friend 9 weeks ago found a dog that had been abandoned there. 1 week later, she gave birth to five puppies. My friend has found a home for three of those puppies, and she still has two that need to find homes. She has not advertised in any newspaper, but if she did, she certainly should not be given a fine for not having a litter permit. She saved the dog's life and has done her best to do right by those puppies. And I would hope in the current situation she would not get a fine. I know when I was a judge on animal court, we had a case like that, and I refused to fine the person because they took in a dog. They were trying to do right by someone. They didn't purposely breed the dog. I think that's all. Just again, I know that the staff has worked very hard on this, but I would just... I do have real concerns about the low-income folks and raising that $50. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Westone?
Hi, I'm Mary Whetstone. I'm president of ASA Animal Services Auxiliary. We were founded on the issue of spaying and neutering 19 years ago. We have spent thousands of dollars to help pet owners spay and neuter their pets. Tonight, I'm addressing only the portion of the proposed two-tier skate fees. The skate program was set up by the county to aid and encourage pet owners to spay and neuter their pets. The program was so successful it ran out of money. The proposed increased fee would raise the purchase price of a voucher from $50 to $72 for the low-income pet owners, and from $50 to $140 for other pet owners. ASA urges you to keep the $50 fee for the low-income pet owners. Most of these pet owners are on public assistance to even put food on their table. Just where is their priority to spay or neuter their pets? Last year, in just one area alone, 3,500 animals were impounded at approximately the cost of $125 per animal. It would have been cheaper and more humane to have provided those pet owners with a $50 voucher. By raising the fee to $72, these pet owners will not make it. They couldn't even make it without assistance at $50. We also urge that the proposal for the $140 fee for the other pet owners be reduced to $75. Our county needs to encourage spaying and neutering by making it more affordable to do so. If we do not, the births and deaths of dogs and cats will increase, and so will the shelter's annual budget. You have voted to build a shelter. A new shelter. All of us in the animal welfare organizations and individuals are very thankful. However, thousands of county residents will continue to refer to it as the pound because of the horrendous number of animals that are being killed only because they were born and unwanted. What we need to do, we need to make it affordable for the pet owners. These people will not call the shelter a shelter. They will not refer to it as a shelter. They want to, even the people who find animals, the pet owners and people who find animals would rather abandon these animals than take them to the pound. They feel that the animals will luck out. They think that the pound is a certain death, but because of the deaths of most animals entering there, they know it's a sure thing for these animals. So they would rather abandon these animals and hope for the best. Hope that maybe somebody will adopt them. Hope that maybe the owners will find them. They do not have confidence in this shelter. We have to have confidence in the shelter. A new building is not going to do it. And so the cycle perpetuates itself with the need to hire more officers to impound these animals, and the shelter budget continues to grow. And then the animals' lives are at stake. For they have no voice. They can't tell you they want to live, but they would if they could. In today's economy, you should not be increasing pet owners' fees for spaying and neutering. They are wanting to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Please help them and help them and help the animals. Do not increase the cost for the escape program that we presented to you. We have to turn off the tap. Otherwise, the tap is going to overflow. Please help us to turn off the tap. You saw, and I gave you some brochures there, you saw how in the verses there, how fast and how frequent these animals reproduced. As a taxpayer myself and as most taxpayers, we would vote to have the people, have you spend our money on prevention, spaying and neutering, rather than increase the numbers to be killed and hire people to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Susan Robinson.
Susan Robinson. I live in Modesto. Just a quick plug for the pet overpopulation ordinance. When the people population of an area goes up, the impounds will also go up. Whether the impounds have gone up more than they should have, according to the raven population, is unknown. I agree that the litter permits are probably more trouble than they're worth. It took me a long time to figure out whether I agree with these new fee increases, and for the most part I do, but I see problems with the skate program increases. The skate program is turning into a program that might be for large dogs only. And this is because only owners of large dogs will consider those fees a good deal. Hundreds of dogs and cats will remain unfixed and will breed, and thousands of their descendants will end up at the shelter. And here we find the rationale for publicly funded low-cost spay-neuter. It is cheaper for taxpayers to subsidize spay-neuter of dogs and cats now than to pay for the housing and killing of their descendants next year. Those dog owners who are actually cited for unlicensed, unaltered dogs will feel forced to buy the $72 or $140 vouchers. Other dog owners and cat owners certainly will not be motivated to buy them. I can get a female cat fixed, vaccinated for upper respiratory and rabies, and defleed and dewormed at my vet for less than the $140 voucher already. And a male cat for much, much less than that. How are you going to make the rest of the pet owners accept financial responsibility for fixing their pets? I would love to really slap the responsibility onto every pet owner. I really do believe in that. Those people that are having unwanted litters will either dump the puppies and kittens or give them away unfixed, and I was disappointed to hear the former animal court judge say she let somebody off for passing around unfixed puppies. Part of my purpose in overpopulation ordinance was to convince people that any time you place an unfixed puppy or kitten, you are responsible for all the descendants of that animal. You're only doing a rescue if you place a fixed animal. You are just spreading around the population problem when you are finding homes for unfixed puppies or kittens. I would also agree that the pet stores that are trying to sell unfixed puppies or kittens that they have dumped on them are a problem. They are just spreading around more breeding animals. Those that are having the unwanted litters who don't dump them or try to give them away will take them to the pound and lie to avoid the relinquishment fee and say the animals were dumped on them. You know people will do this because they're doing it now. How many cases of dumping of litters or lying upon relinquishment have ever been prosecuted here? People know they will get away with it. We need to prevent these litters before they happen. One way is to publicly fund low-cost spay-neuter. $72 is not low-cost in today's economic environment. There was a very compelling letter to the editor of The Bee recently about the idea of offering low-cost vouchers only to those who are already a burden to taxpayers through other public subsidies. What about the struggling middle class? Yes, there are wealthy people with no shame who will use the low-cost vouchers. It will take years to change the attitudes of people who won't spend their money on their own pets. Meanwhile, we need to get those animals fixed because the taxpayers will be paying for the sheltering of the descendants of the pets of the wealthy owners, just the same as the descendants of pets of low-income owners. Almost daily, I encounter owners of unfixed tame cats or unfixed unlicensed dogs, or people who feed feral cats but make no effort to get them fixed, or people giving away unfixed puppies or kittens. I, and others like me, need an anonymous way to inform these people about the spay-neutering and licensing requirements. Here is another way to prevent litters. Citizens need a flyer we can download from the Animal Services website that we can leave on an owner's doorstep or a feral cat feeding area. And we need an Animal Services hotline to call if the flyer doesn't spur the people to take action. Community members need this flyer and phone hotline to help prevent the unplanned breeding of cats and dogs in their own neighborhoods. The animal services officers can't do it all on their own. And if you want higher rates of voluntary licensing compliance, you need to greatly increase the allowable number of pets per household. Many people don't license because they have way more than the allowable number of pets, and they would be found out if they tried to license them. And most importantly, when are you going to enact some real cat population control? Right now is a good time. The cat population problem is much more severe than the dog population problem. Let's stop ignoring it. Here is the ultimate way to prevent more litters. Make it mandatory for every owned non-purebred cat to be fixed and vaccinated for rabies by age 5 months. The cat fanciers can't object because it doesn't apply to purebreds, and feral cats already have their own requirements. Pet cats have nothing but an ineffective retroactive litter permit currently. Make a whopping $1,000 fine for failing to spay or neuter, and don't waive it for any reason. Enact this cat population control now. Lastly, I would like to see a survey of what veterinarians in other counties are charging for participating in the various low-income spay-neuter programs and what additional services they are entitled to require of the pet owner using the program. There are about 5 really good vets in this county who give back all the time. The rest of them I have seen do little to nothing, and I think they're taking advantage of this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Judy. Robert Stanford.
I'm here, I guess, for the same reason, but kind of got a little bit of a different take on this. And it's not that I don't care about animals or anything, but everything that I really agree with what the last person said, but everything these people are saying affect the work that I'm trying to do and things I'm trying to accomplish in the communities I concentrate on, airport districts, El Modesto, all through series, kind of. But see, like, they're, you know, what's your name again?
Dave, yeah.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Dave Young.
Right. Mr. Young said that nobody from the public was stepping up to the plate to do anything about controlling our spay and neuter program. I mean, our problem of overpopulation, these people that you've heard come before you, they are. And they have the, Mary with the San Luis County Animal Services Auxiliary is coming out to our airport district at the substation. And they're going to be able to do 15 dogs and 10 cats for spay and neuter for $5 and rabies shots for $2. Now, the demographics out in this area, which is why I'm saying they're talking to you, people out in this area, this is something they can afford. You can raise it all you want. That's because there's no way that they can afford $50. That's just, they have to make choices that they're, I would be mad at them if they did spay or neuter their animals, because they ain't got that. We're talking poor people. And I don't know if we're affecting the rest of Modesto, but I tell you, at least a few times a week, I'm running down the street because I'm being chased by a dog. I see cats dead all the time on the streets. I very seldom see animal control, though I have seen them a lot more this year. And it's like nobody seems to give tickets for anything in airport or South Modesto. They seem to go around Sherwood area, and they go around the nicer places where they know they got the money. There's no enforcement. There's no education. I've been trying to get some stuff out about avian bird flu. I've been trying to talk about the problems we have with cockfighting. We have real bad problems with, I think I've talked to you about this before. I know you've heard me talk about we have pit bull breeding going on that we don't seem to be able to stop. They put different colored lights in the window, and it's just out of control. But, I mean, it's the $50 for low income, I don't care what you do with the rest of the income, but the $50, I don't see these vouchers going anywhere in my district. I don't see how that could ever work. It just can't. And it's just like the lady said and a couple other people said. These people, they will dump them, et cetera. You know, what happens is it's like when we talked about the meds last time. This is something that we can do. This will, if we just adjust that part of it, we can save money over the course of some animal control. We can put a dent in this because there's no way they can do it. That's pretty much all I got to say. But there's got to be you can put in all the incentive you want, but it makes it impossible for people that are on public assistance even to be able to afford that. It's just absolutely not in the budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Laura, Evna? Okay, that's good.
Good evening, Chairman. Good evening, Board. I'm currently the owner of a one-year-old Old English Sheepdog in Stanislaus County. Winston is licensed in Stanislaus County. He's unaltered, so when I adopted him 8 months ago, I paid $100 for his license. It was very frustrating because he's under lock and key 24/7 unless he's on the leash with me, and so therefore there would be no way he would be able to escape or mount another female without permission from me or, you know, without my sponsorship. He is unaltered because our vet, Dr. Santos in Turlock, said that it's not necessary for him. He would be a lot healthier because he retains muscle mass as he gets older, and his general health would be a lot better. And sheepdogs are not mild-mannered, more so when they're spayed or neutered. Sorry. I plan to use him for breeding in the future when he's older, and he is AKC registered. After researching several cities and their policies, I was surprised by our high licensing fee. For instance, City of Livermore charges $5.50 for 1 year license, spayed and neutered. 1 year license, non-spayed and neutered, $11. For Orange County, they were the highest, $95 for unsterilized dogs, $23 for sterilized. Placer County, dog license altered, $11. Dog license unaltered, $23. Spayed and neutered in Oregon, Lake Oswego, $17 for spayed and neutered, $35 for unaltered. I have $10 here for spay or neutered pets and $25 for animals that aren't spayed or neutered, and that's in Virginia Beach. And then Colorado, counties of Golden, Lakewood, et cetera. For a spay or neutered dog, it's $15, and the fee for an unaltered dog is $30. And so I went through looking at all these fees, thinking, okay, well, we're up with Orange County. We're even higher than Orange County, and I know they have a problem. But I don't think that's the answer for $150 for me to pay for my Old English Sheepdog, when the purpose of that, obviously, is for him not to be out breeding with other animals and creating a problem. For somebody like me that's a law-abiding citizen, it's ludicrous for me to have to pay that kind of money. I understand I'm not the norm. You're trying to bring the population of dogs down, but like she said, cats are a bigger problem. I have a cat. It's microchipped. It's neutered, and it's fine, but it's kind of insult to those of us that are law-abiding citizens to get another raise of $150. Thank you.
Thank you. Elizabeth Camp?
Thank you for giving me this time to say what I feel is important. I can understand wanting to raise the fees for the spay neuter and so forth, but I don't see it working with a lot of the low-class, low-income people because they don't do it now with the $50 because they can't afford the $50. I've talked to many people in my area, and I live in Ceres, which is not as bad as the airport area. And the people I've talked to about getting their animals spayed or neutered, they don't have the money. They can't even pay the rent, let alone pay for to have their dog spay or neuter that they've had for years. And like my neighbor that I've tried to talk to her, she's going to get an eviction notice tomorrow. Now, she's not going to be able to come up with $50 to get her dog spayed, not when she's going to be evicted. And this is the kind of situation that I'm seeing. It's not going to cure it by going up for these people that are really low income. For your average people, I think that's a good idea. But most of your people in our area are lower income than that, and they just don't make it. I've been volunteering with ACE now for quite a few years. I also help out with taking in the little pups or what are kittens that are need a fostering from the shelter. And it's very, you know, really tugs at my heart when I'm having these little animals at home and then I take them back to shelter. And my husband has almost said, no more, you know, because he doesn't like it when he has to love something and then give it up. But I don't know. I just don't see how it's going to solve the problem that we're having. All I see all the time are pit bulls all over the place. And there's no way of controlling that. At least I don't see it at this time unless I don't know what else can be done. It would cost a lot of money to really control that problem. And I think they're the main problem in our county at this time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Joyce, gentlemen.
Good evening. I'm Joyce Gandelman, and among other things, I am a volunteer for English Springer Spaniel Rescue of America called ESRA. And for the past 18 months since I've been a volunteer, I have fostered approximately 15 dogs, about a dozen Springers, a couple of Boxers, a Border Collie, and I happen to be the owner of a wonderful Boxer named Max Bear that I adopted from the local pound. ESRA charges an adoption fee of $250 for Springers that we adopt out. Now that fee, although it covers the cost of the new increased fee for the skate certificate, doesn't pay for things such as the Springer I have at home right now. We just had to go through heartworm treatment and that cost $1,200. Fortunately, there is money in the coffers and people do donate, so, you know, those dogs do get taken care of. ESRA has really enjoyed the $50 fee that we've had to pay for skate certificates. And we will support the increased fee to $140 because we'd rather pay the $140 than not have the certificate at all. Because if we do, my vet charge is probably $250 to get a dog neutered, and that doesn't include all the other fees as well. So we are in support of having skate certificates at whatever cost it is, if it's $140, as long as it's not $250. What I would like to suggest, however, is that for people who are with rescue groups, that we do not have to, that we can purchase our skate certificates over the counter when we rescue a dog. Right now, we have to go to the clinics. Many times, we have dogs that we do not know what their dispositions are. They may be sick, and they could possibly spread disease to other dogs. If they're not a nice, friendly dog, and we don't even know it until we get them next to another dog, it could cause problems. So my suggestion is that you allow legitimate foster groups to purchase their skate certificates over the counter when we rescue a dog. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to the board tonight before I close the public hearing? Okay, seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Close the public hearing. Is there anyone on the board who would like to address some of these things? Okay, I'll start down this way. Jeff, anything?
I don't have any comments.
Okay. Dean Martini?
I'm not sure what to do with this, you know, and I'm not sure that raising the fees is going to make things any better. Although on the other hand, it's a conservative bent to me that, you know, that tells me that taking care of your animals is really not the government's responsibility to heavily subsidize it. And I know last year we put in over $200,000 extra into this program. But with all the money that we're putting into this spayed and neutering and skate vouchers, the time we spend on this animal ordinance, I just can't understand why the animal population is getting worse instead of better. But I'm not convinced that just raising the fees is going to make anything better. I mean, you know, some of the proposals that you have are
I'm fine with. Like, you're charging to pick up horses and cows. I mean, I see that's new, but I'm not sure where I'm going to go on this, but I just think that if you raise the fees too much, that you know, people just won't do it. But then, is it really the taxpayer's responsibility to subsidize, you know, spayed and neutering? I mean, if you can't afford an animal, you shouldn't have one. People have children they can't afford too. It doesn't seem to stop them. I don't know. I want to listen to some of the other boys.
Okay, we'll set it down there. Bill?
Yeah, I have several comments. First of all, I've always wanted to put as much resources to spay and neuter as possible, and I've taken some criticism for that, but I continue in that quest. With the skate program, it's not really the conservative versus liberal view of, hey, it's not taxpayers' responsibility, because I don't see that this board is going to reduce its level of funding into the skate program. Right now, we're selling out of the skate vouchers. Raising the fees would allow more animals to be spayed and neutered under this program. The two-tier system intrigues me, but I almost think it needs to be three tiers. And the third tier added is the very low income. And that's where the neuter scooter comes in place. When this animal shelter gets built, I really hope we see the neuter scooter out into the very low-income areas to provide those services to the very low-income people. I also agree with one of the speakers who has in the past said we need to use the skate vouchers as soon as possible, get them out there as fast as possible, in order to get these animals spayed and neutered that are out there. I do agree with that, and I do, and Mr. Young, I heard you mention that. However, I'm finding a fatal flaw in this whole change, and that has to do with the smaller animals, both in dog and cat, with the $140 skate voucher. By taking your numbers, Mr. Young, those are the two slides you presented to us where currently your $50 goes to and the charges we're seeing from the vets. If you take the small cat of $52 surgery fee and add in a $12 license, $6 rabies, $17 microchip, you come to $87. And yet we would charge $140 to a non-low-income person to get that skate voucher. That's not an incentive. I did the same math on the small dog, the $98 surgery charge with the same $12, $6, and $17 comes to $133. Closer, but still not quite to that $140. I do support changing the fee structure, absolutely. But I think we need to take a closer look in getting it dialed in a little better, which is going to make it a whole more complex. By you look, you have a small dog, medium dog, largest dog, male versus female. But I agree with Mrs. Robinson and said this may just cater to the large dogs. And on the cat side of it, I don't even know if there's going to be incentive for a cat at all to get a skate voucher for a cat. And that's where our biggest problem is.
Can I respond to that?
Absolutely.
You know, let's finish.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you asking a question? Is that what you want to know? Or?
That's the end of my comments. I'd love for him to challenge my thinking.
Okay, I'll let you challenge him. Just get one more. Dick, you got something you want to talk about?
Well, you can go ahead and answer.
Okay, all right, go ahead and
answer.
All right.
I do have a comment.
Okay.
It's been our experience at Animal Services that the local veterinary community as a whole, there are exceptions, but as a whole, the local veterinary community is not into donating their time or lowering their fees. They went to years and years of medical school and got a medical degree, and they feel like they should be able to charge appropriately. Our county veterinarian, who we just hired, has been out of medical school and practicing for 10 years, and he says he still has $100,000 in student loans to pay off. So to me, I can understand why some members of the veterinary community are not willing to do a lot of donation of their time or to lower their fees, but our experience has been that they do not want to lower their fees. The fee schedule that you have in front of you now caused a lot of consternation for at least the CEO's office and Animal Services about a year and a half ago when they negotiated those fees, because the private trade organization that was in on the negotiations retained an attorney who advised all the local veterinarians not to sign any contract with the county on the veterinarian fees. So those fees that you have right now before you are a gentleman's agreement, so to speak, and those private veterinarians can raise those fees at any time that they want, and they're going to be more inclined to raise their fees than to lower their fees. It's also my opinion that most of the veterinarians in this community charge higher fees than what our voucher is going to pay for. That voucher is not only paying for the spaying and the neutering, but the voucher is also paying for a microchip and it's paying for a license. So there's more rolled into it. My personal opinion is that if you're asking me to go back out into the community and renegotiate with the private veterinarians, I'm telling you that nobody in the past has ever been successful in doing that. If you're asking that I go back out into the community and try to find some private source, some coalition of people who are willing to help finance, again, I would say that we have not been successful in doing that in the last 20 years.
No, I let me just stop you. I'm not asking you to do any of that. What I'm asking you to do is, if you're a cat owner and the most expensive spay or neuter, according to your information, is $100 for the surgical charge that we're paying veterinarians, and you add in the $12 license, the $6 rabies, and the $17 microchip, comes to, I believe, $135. Why would you pay $140 to get that?
Because it's cheaper than going out on the private market.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Dick?
Well, first of all, it seems that we're caught in a situation where low-income feels they can't afford it, and yet the veterinarians feel they're entitled to pay for their education, and et cetera. So we're kind of caught into a situation. You know, I can hear both sides, but I also feel that we're asked to come up with some solutions, and I don't believe there's a magic wand in this whole situation. But as I recall, when you first started on your presentation, you said that you wanted to come back to us in 6 months or period of time.
Yes, sir.
At this time, although we can agree or disagree on portion of it, I would like to go forward with this, and in 6 months you have a chance to make an evaluation. We're making some assumptions here, and I'm not saying these assumptions aren't correct, but we have to start with some basis or foundation to address this issue. And I believe if this is put into practice in 6 months, if it doesn't work, we'll know. If it works, and then maybe we can make adjustments accordingly. But I do not believe that we're going to be able to satisfy everyone in this issue. I've said several times, first of all, that, you know, we're looking at a new animal shelter, bricks and mortar, but that's not going to solve our animal problem. I do believe that somewhere along the line, I'm hoping that we can put together a coalition of animal lovers and work out that they can start applying for some of these grants that we can't. And I'm hoping that we can put some people together that you need a money person to manage it, and then you need someone who's a very good manager of people, because there's a lot of different feelings out there. And I truly believe whatever schedule we use is not going to work until we're able to get the volunteer groups together. And that, to me, is the secret of this. And so, as much as I may agree and disagree with this schedule, I think it's a starting point, and hoping that we can reach out to people in the community who I know are interested in making contributions. It's a matter of setting it up properly. Let's see if we're right or wrong on this. In the 6 months or whatever period of time, come back to us. And I hope that what you're suggesting works. But time will tell, and we're not talking about a long period of time, and it gives us somewhere to start. So I would vote for this under those conditions.
Do you think in 6 months that you would be able to come back and give us some facts and figures that, as opposed to what we've heard now, like Dick said?
Yes. I think that would be a very reasonable request, and I think that we would certainly see immediately whether people are still going to make use of the voucher program. I think we'll know that in the first month.
Somebody talked about you couldn't buy vouchers at the shelter?
Correct.
Why?
We only, it had been prior to the last director's tenure that we only sold the vouchers at clinics. And the major reason for that was to limit the number of vouchers so that it would stay within the budget that the board had established. My predecessor instituted a program of handing the vouchers out over the counter, and what occurred was in most years you would have 12 to 1400 vouchers for the entire year. That particular year when we were handing them out over the counter, we handed out 4,000. So we almost tripled the number of vouchers, and that busted the budget. And so you gentlemen had to supplement our budget to the tune of, I think, about $325,000, or we would have gone into the red. So, you know, that proves that, on the one hand, if we make the vouchers available, people are going to make use of them. But on the other hand, someone has to pay the bill.
Well, why can't we count? Why can't we count them? I mean, you're giving them at the... Why can't we keep a count at the shelter of how many vouchers we give out? I mean, okay, if you want to hand out 200 a month or 300 or whatever it happens to be, I mean, once you hit the voucher limit for that month, somebody out there can count. We got 200 out, that's it.
We could do that, but then what would happen is I would hurt some feelings like I did this year.
Well, it's going to hurt them anyhow, Dave. I mean, we're going to hurt a lot of feelings. I can guarantee you we're going to hurt a lot of feelings. One way or the other, no matter, this is not a win-win situation. You know, this is not an animal problem, this is a people problem. It's always been a people problem. When somebody got up and they talked about three litters a year, okay, this is no joke. I mean, I know from first hand, they have three litters a year, okay, and before you get a pregnant cat dropped off at your house, I can guarantee you she'll be pregnant again two more times before that year's out. You may start with one cat, then you'll have seven cats, then you'll have 14 cats, then you'll have 21 cats. I mean, this is the way it is. It's the same with dogs. A lot of these people are not responsible. They'll get pregnant, they'll take them out and drop them off along the county road. Somebody will pick them up, and even like the court said, she felt sorry for them, and so do I. But these people, I'm telling you, you're not going to get everybody to get your cats and dogs sprayed and neutered. Okay, you're going to worm them. You're going to worm them. You're going to put a chip in them. I mean, they're going to weigh 10 pounds less when they come back. But the situation is, I'd like to come back and see it in 6 months. If it doesn't change, if things go completely the other way, then you'll have to change it.
Yes, sir. Okay.
I think we've coerced Mr. Young out of retirement at least three times. We've coerced him out of retirement at least three times to come in and attempt to deal with our problem.
No.
He's immersed into it fully, and I think this is his best attempt at moving us forward. And I make a motion that we approve what the staff recommends, and let's look at it again in 6 months.
I'll second.
Okay, I got a motion and a second. Now we get to take the vote. Okay, all in favor of that motion that we'll look at this again in 6 months. If things go to pot, we'll know where we're at.
Yes.
Okay, if they look better, we know where we're at. Okay, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Oh, 5-0. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck.
We'll see you in
6 months.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask one request of the department, and that's to keep track, very good records of where these skate buses are going. Obviously low-income versus non-low-income,
yes.
But maybe size of dog or surgery cost, so we can get a true feeling for where we are, because
yes.
I have a funny feeling we're going to need to modify it.
Okay. We'll do that.
Okay. Okay, now we go down to correspondence.
This board has received copies of the South Los County Civil Grand Jury 2007-08 reports regarding correctional facilities inspections and containing the emerging threat of hepatitis C through a syringe exchange program.
I'm going to refer this to the Chief Executive Officer of Health Services Agency, the Sheriff, and the Chief Probation Officer.
This board has received a letter from Indilex Aluminum Solutions updating their plans to discontinue and close their Modesto facility located at 4555 North Star Way, Modesto, California. The termination of employees expected to take place beginning July 18, 2008, per the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act.
Refer this to the Alliance WorkNet and the Sasol County Economic Development and Workforce Alliance.
This board has received a letter from the Children and Families Commission requesting opposition to SBX 316 Cox and other or any other legislation that would divert Proposition 10 resources and or remove local control of how the resources are used in San Luis County.
We're going to refer this to the Chief Executive Officer, but I just want to ask one question about this. Is this where the Prop 10 money was the cigarette money, right? I think.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so what does somebody want to divert? It's getting a little bit too fat. They want to divert the money someplace else?
It's our understanding that there's several legislative proposals and discussions to divert money from the Prop 10 dedicated money for the Children's and Family First Commission to the state budget crisis, as well as discussions are underway about diverting Proposition 63 funds from the Mental Health Services Act. And in my Legend Fiscal Report, I'm going to tell you that today they're talking about diverting funds from Proposition 1A away from counties and cities and Proposition 42, the transportation fund. So in Sacramento, there are robust discussions about taking money away from these dedicated funds to help with the state budget crisis.
At some point, when we refer this to the Chief Executive Officer, is at some point that we can talk about this? I don't know how he feels about it.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we're going to bring you back some discussion and a recommendation regarding this. We're going to have some additional requests to weigh in on these other legislative proposals as well.
Thank you. Bring
this back to you.
Thank you.
This board has received a letter from the Turtles Mosquito Abatement District regarding the West Nile virus and the control of mosquitoes in Stanislaus County.
Refer this to the Health Services Agency and the Department of Environmental Resources. Number 5, didn't somebody want to talk about that? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Come on up. You want to talk about that? Go ahead.
Does she want to read the letter first?
Yeah, go ahead and read it.
Okay. The board has received a letter from Save Our Society from Drugs, SOS, requesting that the board reject needle exchange programs in our community.
Yes, and that was in reference to the grand jury's report recommendation. I just want to read up into a very short letter I wrote to the BIA a couple of days ago regarding this and sums up everything. I applaud the San Luis County Grand Jury for the recommendation of a needle exchange program in our community as a means of stemming the tide of infectious disease throughout our entire community. Not only does needle exchange programs reduce the spread of bloodborne illnesses such as HIV and hepatitis C, it also offers a consistent opportunity to provide information and encouragement to intravenous drug users regarding treatment and counseling, as well as addressing other health issues arising from high-risk behavioral lifestyles. with the overwhelming failure of Proposition 36, drug addiction treatments available to drug users and or offenders are underutilized except by those offenders fortunate enough to be ordered to drug court. With no accountability to continue, the offender is given little more than a sheet of paper in terms of support and alternatives to their current lifestyle. Proposition 36 drug offenders are left to their own devices to deal with their drug addiction by themselves. Needle exchange is in no way condoning intravenous drug use. It is an effective approach to saving lives by reducing not only the rates of deadly disease, but also promoting education for drug users regarding existing opportunities available to them for treatment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to refer this to Chief Executive Officer and the Health Services Agency.
This board has received a letter from J.S. West and companies requesting opposition to Proposition Number 2, Treatment of Farm Animal Statute, which will appear on the November 4th, 2008 ballot.
We're going to refer this to Chief Executive Officer.
This board has received a letter from Californians Against Waste requesting support of SB 1625, Hobart, regarding expanding California's recycling law to include all plastic bottles.
We're going to refer this to your Chief Executive Officer, and he's going to be a busy guy, isn't he? Go ahead.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
Acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to the Chief Executive Office Risk Management Division. Is there any Board of Supervisors reports? Dean Martini, you got one?
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about this SBX3, the Children and Families Commission. This isn't anything more than the state of California just stealing the money away from the cities and the counties again. And I don't mean to criticize Dick Monteith on this. I know he used to be there. But the state legislature, it has just done this over and over to the counties. And with the Prop 63, it was the same story. It's nothing more than a tax-to-rich scheme. It was only supposed to go to the mental health department, and now they want to steal that too, which is something they said they would not do. Prop 10 money should stay here in Stanislaus County, and we should at least oppose the state trying to steal it to put in whatever, you know, their shortfalls are. I'm not surprised, but I'm really opposed to taking this money out and letting the state have it.
That's why I asked Patty Hill Thomas, our assistant CEO tonight, would we hear this again? And she said we would hear this again, Mr. DeMartini, and then we can actually vote no on this next time.
Yeah, I was going to make a comment about this anyway tonight.
You were?
I know it's coming up. And
you're not a man that makes a lot of comments, I know.
Okay. Well, I haven't made any of the last few meetings.
Okay. Is there anyone that, Dick, you got anything to say?
All I'll say on the Prop 10 there, at this time, for the legislature to take it, it takes a two-thirds vote. Although that may not be as difficult as it sounds, because if they put it in a budget, you need a two-thirds vote. So, also they're talking about not only taking that money, but money that's not committed. And I happen to be on this 10 committee, locally here, but, money that's not committed, and we've always had a policy to keep money in reserve to run for 1 year. And I think that's a very prudent way to run business. But there is a possibility that uncommitted money they want to take also. So it's one of those things that no one knows exactly what's going to happen, but they're looking for money. And I know in this committee we've discussed possibilities. We're also confronted with the fact that this is tobacco money, and the consumption of tobacco is going down, so that we know probably that maybe perhaps in 5 years we're not going to have funds for these programs. So there's many complications in it. And the other thing that I think perhaps we should take in consideration is, if by chance the legislature does take this money, do they then turn around and mandate it, and say the county has to pick up the difference? So there's a lot of things involved in this thing that we need to protect ourselves on.
Okay, Nick, I just told DeMartini, maybe I'll bring a pack of cigarettes next time. It's all light up. Bill O'Brien, you got something?
Well,
Okay, with that, we live legislative, fiscal, and management report from Patty Hill Thomas.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I won't start with budget. I will start with the heat incident, though. I just wanted you to know that over the last week, our County Office of Emergency Services and our countywide staff have been very involved in the heat incident that we experienced here in the Central Valley and beyond. It was nice to see the bee recognize the efforts of the county, the cities, the Red Cross, and a real coming together of our cities and our county staff. Really a special thanks to Gary Henshaw and Chief Wilkinson at OES, RPIO, David Jones, who I know spent a lot of nights writing public information, Dr. Walker and his entire staff, and all the cities, a real collaborative effort to make sure the community was well advised and focused on what to do to stay cool as possible. Just for your reference and for the public, our stancounty.com OES portion of the website took more than 32,000 hits during the heat days last week. Many of those multiple users, and from what they could see, were more than 1,200 distinctly different individuals checking in on the information there. So fortunately, it's a little cooler here, but we stay focused and thought you should be up to date on the efforts of our county staff. OES has been very busy statewide as our attention is turned to the wildfires. Our county OES is managing our local resources used, and we have firefighters and resources from Stanislaus County at the Hummingbird Fire, Butte, Big Sur, Shasta County, the Sonoma Niles Canyon, and the Carmel Valley. There are and have been more than 120 firefighters from Stanislaus County out of the county since the lightning strikes began, and that's a significant resource. So a special thanks to them as well. We got good news today on a federal budget appropriation. It's not a completed deal yet, but our federal lobbyist advised us that the Orestimba Creek Flood Control Project has received a recommendation from Senator Feinstein for $400,000, and that's a good step. It's not done, but we're pleased with that, and I wanted to report that to you tonight. On the state budget crisis, our view is that the condition is worsening, and it's been fairly quiet. I think, as your board knows, there have been a lot of private discussions over the last couple of days, and this afternoon, our legislative advocate, Don Peterson, and CSAC, the organization representing the counties, have come to every county saying there is serious discussion about, one, withholding local funds under the provisions of Prop 1A. You may recall a couple years ago the state used those local funds essentially to help balance the state budget. Under that proposition, they can come back one more time in a 10-year period. Fortunately, in Stanislaus County, under your board's direction, we've reserved the funds for that additional hit, but it is a significant loss to local government, and we don't think it is an appropriate loss. The discussion around Prop 42 transportation funds, much like the one we just had a few minutes ago, talking about the Prop 10 funds and Supervisor DeMartini's comments about Prop 63, could present and would present a significant shortfall to our transportation fund projects in Stanislaus County. Initial estimates that it would be anywhere from $4.5 million to possibly as high as $5.2 million in anticipated road projects under Prop 42 in our own community. We're very concerned about that. While there's not much going on publicly, there's much going on privately, and there was talk this afternoon that there could be a budget deal in the next 3 days or so. The budget crisis continues to be further threatened by the prison and the federal court and the receivership issue, which presents a huge financial issue to the state of California. We were asked today, and we intend to comment back to the state, that the Prop 1A exposure for the county would be a significant loss for us. Our estimate is $4.1 to $4.5 million, and the Prop 42 loss would be significant to our transportation projects, perhaps exceeding $5 million in our new fiscal year. We have lots of detail on the budget, and we have several county staff here remaining today. We're staying vigilant in terms of watching the budget action and staying involved but I suspect that you will see lots more of requests to ask your board to weigh in on the different legislative proposals that seem to be coming forward now pretty rapidly. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Is there any questions for Patty Hill Thomas? Seeing none on this side, how about this side? No? Are you finished?
I am. Thank you.
Very good report. Thank you. We're adjourned.